This is The Naked Scientists, and this week we're talking about the science of explosives, explosions and ordnances. Later on we'll be actually doing our own bit of detonation and kitchen science. Stay tuned for that. But before then, Cambridge University's Graham McShane is with us, and he's been doing some very interesting work on looking at what happens when you blow things up both on land and underwater. Graham, welcome to The Naked Scientists. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Yep.
So tell us first of all, actually, what actually happens when something explodes? How do you try and understand that?
Okay, well, the starting point excuse me, for any explosion is a lump of solid explosive. And when that explosive detonates, it rapidly converts into high-pressure, high-temperature gas. And that gas then expands and it pushes on its surroundings. And that generates a pressure pulse or a shock wave, which propagates away from the explosion and will strike some kind of structure that's nearby. And the type of loading that explosion generates depends strongly on the medium that's surrounding that explosive. And as you said, we've looked at a couple of different types. So one type might be water. So the explosive might be a bomb or a detonation or something under the water next to a ship. So when that gas expands, it pushes on the water, compresses the water, and sends a shockwave towards your ship structure.
So a depth charge.
A depth charge or something like that, that's right.
Something would be important.
That's right. And water's particularly dangerous from that point of view because it's a very stiff material, water. It's very difficult to compress. So that means that the pressures that can build up around the explosive are very large. So you can get shock pulses with very high peak pressures.
So if a depth charge does go off within a reasonably close proximity of a ship's hull or a submarine or something, how do you work out how much force is then transmitted onto the hull of the vessel?
Well, that's very difficult to do. So in terms of a research exercise, there are various things we could do to try and analyse what the loading that blast imparts to the structure is. So one thing we can do is we can try to simulate it in the lab. We can try to experimentally simulate an underwater shock pulse.
You don't have to build a warship or something.
Well, not quite a warship. We can reduce it down to maybe a small piece of a panel of the side of a ship. And we can have a simulator where we can simulate the type of pressure pulse that you see in water near to an explosion. And then we can measure directly what the momentum, you know, the velocity that's imparted to that structure is. Another thing we can do is we can do calculations. So we can run calculations where we simulate the pressure loading on a structure, and then we can extract all sorts of information like the deformation of the structure and the forces that are required to hold the panel in place.
So does this mean that people are now able to build better ships and better subs so that when these kind of shockwaves slam into them, they dissipate the energy better so that you don't get a hole punched in the side, for instance?
Yes, well, we've certainly come up with a number of ideas for different types of materials that can help to protect ships better. So some types of materials, some examples are things like sandwich structures, which you sometimes find in aeroplanes to provide you with a very light and stiff structure. So these types of structures, you have solid face sheets with a lightweight deformable core in between them. And that core can crush and dissipate some energy. And these types of structures are very good at mitigating the effects of a blast near to the structure. But then these things are much more expensive than conventional materials, so there's always a question of how much money you're prepared to spend to protect your ship.
But then, given the massive cost of a ship, it probably must be worth that, because if you lose the vessel, you've lost a huge amount, haven't you?
That's right. But then the cost could be enormous. It could be a huge amount extra. I mean, these types of materials that we've looked at are very much more complicated than a solid steel panel. You have to think about how to fabricate these things, how to make a ship-scale structure out of them, and then how to maintain them as well. So there are lots of added costs, but there are solutions that work well.
And looking on land, yeah. Can you correlate what you understand and what happens in the water, aquatic environment, to what happens on land? Because obviously air is a fluid too, it's just a slightly thinner one.
That's right, yeah. I mean, an explosive in air shares many characteristics with an explosion in water. It starts off with the same basic physical principles. You start off with an explosive which converts to a gas and expands and it compresses the air. The big difference is that the air doesn't compress so much. So the pressures that you generate are different. And also the way that the shock pulse interacts with the structure is also different in air and in land. In air and in water. When the shock pulse reflects off of a ship, it can cause the water to open apart, to cavitate. That doesn't really happen in air. So there are different phenomena going on, and that affects what your optimal solutions are for your material design.
Presumably also, when something explodes on land, it also doesn't just have liquid to play with, it's also got whatever is in the environment around it. So if you're detonating a landmine,
yes,
there will be a huge amount of material from the ground emitted upwards and projected up alongside that rush of air, which in itself is going to be devastatingly harmful, because it presumably will be like sandpaper a thousandfold over, won't it?
Absolutely. A landmine detonation is very different from an explosion in free air far away from anything else. In a landmine explosion, your explosive is initially buried under a layer of soil. So that gas, when it tries to expand, it has to compress that soil, and shockwaves pass through the soil. But then the soil then it expands out and it sprays at the structure at very high velocities. So the loading is very much more complicated for a landmine. And it's taken a lot of research effort to understand what that loading is. Never mind think about what materials are best for protecting vehicles against that type of loading.
So it's not simply just the explosive force of a mine going off. It's the fact that all that material is ejected too, and it totally changes the dynamics of an explosion.
Absolutely. Well, there are a number of factors in it. I mean, first off, when the soil starts to move, it starts to move extremely quickly. So it compresses the air around it, and it'll send a shockwave ahead of it. So there is a bit of an air blast going on there as well. But then following that, you've got the sand flying behind it at very high speed. And then behind that, you've got all the gases, the remnants of the explosive, which follow behind that. So it's a very complicated loading scenario.
And how do you study that?
Well, again, we've got this combination of simple experimental techniques to try and capture the physics of what's going on, and computational methods that can maybe capture more of the real landmine event. We can attempt, to some extent, to simulate in the lab a landmine, but our site, the engineering department, is a city centre location. It's not really suitable for setting off landmines, so we have to think of other ways of throwing soil at structures at high speed. So that's one aspect of the research. And again, we can do a similar thing. We can measure how the structure deforms and responds. We can also use computation as well, where we can try and simulate the sort of sand flows that are generated by these things and look at how different types of materials will behave.
Is this why these improvised explosive devices are so devastating in places like Afghanistan? Because when a car, a Land Rover, whatever, goes over it, if it hasn't got appropriate protection, then it's having to cope with this incredible force, which is all directed at one point on the vehicle.
Precisely. It's very difficult to protect vehicles against this extreme type of loading. You can design vehicles to try and protect the troops inside. You can have very large vehicles with very heavy floors, very far off the ground, because the further away from the landmine you can get, the lower the loads that the landmine imparts on your vehicle. But for a lightweight vehicle like a Land Rover or something like that, it's very difficult to do that. So you have to try and think of some lightweight solutions. And it's very difficult to combine the lightweight that you need in a mobile vehicle and also protection against this rather severe loading.
And the strategy you outline for ships of having this sort of multi-laminar structure, that would work, but just the weight would be a problem.
Well,
or not?
No, that would work as well. You've got this sort of sandwich structure, this layered structure. You've got to think about how heavy is, how much protection can you provide for the same mass of armour. So if I had a solid steel plate, I could compare that with a sandwich plate of the same mass, and it would be more expensive to make, but it's likely to be stiffer. The core can absorb some energy, so it's likely to give you some performance benefits overall.
The prediction is there's something like 110 million landmines scattered around the Earth. People are stepping on them all the time, not just driving Land Rovers over them, and they're often civilians.
Yes.
Is there anything we can do for people who live in at-risk areas so they could wear something to avoid this sandpapering of all their legs to basically strip all the flesh off, which is what these mines are doing to them, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. That's a very difficult problem to solve. The problem is the intensity of the loading, and when you step on a mine, you're very, very close to it. As I say, the further you can get away from a landmine, the better you are. To step on a landmine, it's a very severe loading. It's very hard to think of material solutions to that. The best solutions are to try to remove the landmines somehow, to try to detect them, and to improve vehicles. So you can improve vehicles so that people can get into these areas, find the landmines and remove them. I think that's a more effective solution.
Well, just before we wrap this up with Graham. Helen, you've actually had some experience of this, haven't you? This explosions up close and personal.
That's right. Well, actually, it's the underwater explosions that I've unfortunately had a very close encounter with. And it really kind of hit home to me just how quickly and how far underwater explosions reach. Because I was diving several years ago in Malaysia and unfortunately was in the vicinity of a fish bomb that was thrown in the water. Now, I should just explain quickly that across Southeast Asia, this is a quite prevalent way of catching fish. It's actually illegal in many countries because it's very damaging, not only to the people who occasionally have bombs going off in their hands, but also to the environment. But I was in the water and this enormously loud bang sound ripped through the water. I felt it all the way through my insides, and it was absolutely terrifying. And I guess I knew what it was. I knew that this could happen. So I got out of the water as quickly and safely as I could, and then noticed that the fisherman who'd put this bomb in was miles away. He was actually right across on the horizon. I could just about see him. And I just couldn't believe that this had travelled, you know, quite so far and was still so powerful as to make me feel like, if it had come any closer, it might have deafened me or something. It was terrifying.
Yes, it sounds like a pretty terrifying experience. It just goes to show how efficiently a blast pulse can propagate through water. Although that fisherman was quite some distance away, even his small bit of explosive would have created quite big pressures that would have propagated for quite a large distance.
And I assume if he'd been any closer, I would have been at risk of things like my eardrums rupturing and even my organs sort of damaging if it had been, you know, really very close.
Absolutely, yes. A shock pressure hitting the body will do all sorts of damage, and it's best avoided, so I can understand why they're keen to ban that kind of practice.
Absolutely, and I know now what those poor fish are feeling as well. So, yes, it was a terrifying experience indeed.
Yes, be grateful you're not a fish, Helen, even though you're called scales. Thank you. Well, thanks for sharing that, though. It's fascinating. Thank you, Graham, for commenting on this. Graham McShane, who is from the engineering department at Cambridge University, where he's working on how explosions go off and what the consequences are and perhaps how we can design better ways of mitigating against damage caused by those kinds of explosions.